What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Raphael Medoff, author of the new book, The Jews Should Keep Quiet, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Stephen S. Wise, and the Holocaust. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I have a close friend, Alan, who goes all the way back with me to high school. He refers to my need to teach Judaism as an addiction. Of course, the very word rabbi means essentially teacher, so there's something highly appropriate about that addiction, I suppose. I do like almost everything about the process of teaching people Jewish subjects, seeing understanding and knowledge grow and develop. That motivation, maybe it's a compulsion even, as Alan suggests, is true in every area of Jewish learning at nearly every level. From watching a preschool child learn the Shema for the first time, to discussing complex theological issues with sophisticated adults, to exploring obscure mystical texts in community, I find the process of Jewish learning beautiful and fulfilling nearly always. That's true of this Too Jewish radio show as well, where we strive to entertain, but, you know, also educate. Don't tell anyone about that, by the way. I don't want to give away our secret. Now, in my weekly role, I typically teach 5 or 6 different ongoing Adult Education Academy classes on various subjects. At times, I've taught as many as 7 or 8 a week. The weekly adult classes range from Torah to history to Kabbalah mysticism to Musar, Jewish self-improvement, to Hebrew. Of course, I also teach Bar and Bat Mitzvah students, confirmation students, and the Hebrew school students. But it is in adult teaching that I get to explore new areas and express things most fully and, I hope, clearly. Typically, during the summer, I have usually taken a break from some aspects of my day job as a congregational rabbi to recharge my intellectual batteries, deepen knowledge of various aspects of Judaism, and, well, learn anything interesting. That means that for, the month of July, I usually don't teach adult classes much. But this summer, for the first time in a while, I didn't really take a break. Religious school was off for the last couple of months, so there was less instruction of kids, but I ended up teaching a full Adult Education Academy schedule over the summer, even added a couple of classes. I also attended a Talmud class my wife Sophie's been teaching. That made for a different summer experience, of course, but it also reinforced my strongly motivated love of Jewish learning. There's something kind of magical about the alchemical process of learning along with your students. Even when it's hot outside and you're tired, an incredible Jewish concept can suddenly leap off the page or out of your Kindle or laptop and fire your spiritual imagination. However, there's one exception to this personal rule of mine, a love of all Jewish learning, and that exception is near heretical. I don't like learning or teaching Talmud very much. That is a terrible confession for a rabbi, hopefully not a truly awful one. Now, Talmud, by which we generally mean the Babylonian Talmud, completed in today's Iraq by great Jewish scholars over 1,500 years ago, Talmud is the preeminent text of all Jewish learning. It is the authoritative source for Jewish law, halakha, and the greatest compendium of Jewish legal and legendary information ever assembled. For Orthodox Jews, Jewish learning and Talmud are nearly synonymous, and there are many people of every Jewish stream of religious observance and non-observance all around the world who begin each day studying a daf yomi, a page, actually it's 2 pages of Talmud, every morning. That includes my 96-year-old father and my own wife, among others of all ages. Sophie, my wife, teaches such an engaging Talmud class that her students range in age from 23 to 85, and they are vital and connected throughout the class. Sadly, except for one of them. Now, I have studied a good amount of Talmud in my life, the entire tractates of Brachot, Blessings, and Sanhedrin, which deals primarily with capital offenses, as well as Kiddushin, about weddings, and many other sections of many other tractates. A tractate is a book-length discussion on all the many holidays, on commercial transactions, on many other subjects. I know some Aramaic, the language of most of the Talmud, well. Mostly understand Talmudic reasoning, have explored some of the many commentaries on the Talmud, Rashi, of course, others from ancient to modern, and always got top grades in seminary classes on Talmud. I think I actually won the Talmud Award in rabbinical school. I have studied Talmud in ultra-Orthodox yeshivas in Jerusalem and at Chabad synagogues in California and at Reform Movement study conferences and with conservative rabbis and online and in groups and so on. I can successfully study Talmud, whatever that means, but I have come to a strange conclusion. I don't enjoy studying Talmud, nor do I find it nearly as fulfilling as digging deeper into the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, or exploring Zohar, the greatest text of Jewish mysticism, or reading Jewish philosophy or novels, or learning more Jewish history. When studying Talmud, the same thing always happens to me. I start out engaged and interested, exploring the text and the various winding ways of its arguments and its many seemingly random detours, its associative logic leading it farther and farther afield. And then, every single time I'm in a Talmud class, after about 40 minutes or so, I find that my mind has completely wandered away, and I have no great interest in coming back home to the page of Talmud before me. I also don't want to read or study American legal codes or cases, so maybe it's good I never became yet another Jewish lawyer like so many of my classmates did. Anyway, I'm quite sure this Talmudic aversion is simply a failing of mine that will be rectified in the world to come. But until that occurs, I will continue to love studying and teaching almost every aspect of Jewish learning, from Bible to liturgy to commentaries to music to poetry to archaeology. And I will quote Talmud where required and explain it as needed and respect Talmudic scholars, teachers, and students. May God bless them and extend their lives in health and joy. But I suspect I will never teach a class in Talmud, and I'm unlikely to remain engaged in it as a student. On the other hand, you might like it. I hope you do. Then I won't feel so guilty about not joining you in the mornings on Daf Yomi yet again. Ah, well, to play us in on this summer morning, here's a lovely setting of a non-Talmudic Jewish text, the Ana B'Choach, a mystical praise of God.
Ana, ana bechoach, gdulat yemincha, tatir tzehura, kabel rina, amcha sagveinu, tareinu, tareinu nora. בכוח גדולת ימינך תתיר צרורה קבל רינת עמך סגבנו תרנו נורא נגיבור דורשי ייחודך כבבת שומרם ברכם תרם רחמי צדקתך תמיד גומלם חסין קדוש חסין קדוש ברוב טובך להלדתך יחיד גאה לעמך בני זוכרי קדושתך שבתנו קבל ושמע צעקתנו יודע
ימינך תתיר צרורה.
That was Anna Bechoach, as sung by Odileia Berlin. One more introductory note this morning. My first hero on radio died last week. The great L.A. Dodgers announcer Vin Scully passed away in his 90s after an unbelievable career of close to 70 years as a Dodgers announcer. He painted verbal pictures so beautiful and lyrical you realized you were listening to an incredibly evolving art form that transcended mere sports, even baseball. As I posted on Facebook this week, a devout Catholic, Vin Scully, taught this rabbi a great deal in many important areas of life. May his memory bring only blessings. Our guest this morning, Rafael Medoff, has published a deeply researched new book that explores the relationship between FDR, Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, and the Holocaust. It's an important and painful story about co-option, what the American Jewish community was like in the 30s and 40s, and to a large extent, betrayal. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rafael Medoff has written a fascinating new book, The Jews Should Keep Quiet, Franklin D. Roosevelt's Rabbi Stephen S. Wise and the Holocaust, analyzing, exploring, I think an untalked about, that's probably not exactly the right way to put it, but a not terribly well understood episode in Jewish history and American Jewish history that's extremely important. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you for having me.
So tell us why you wrote this book now.
Because even after all these years and all the research that has been done on the question of how America and American Jewry responded to the Holocaust, there were still important lingering questions. For example, ultimately, what was the reason that President Franklin Roosevelt chose to implement policies to keep Jews out of America during the Holocaust years? Second, why did Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, most prominent Jewish leader of that era, failed to mobilize American Jews in an active way to protest President Roosevelt's policies? And other unanswered questions that are frequently discussed in the Jewish community, but which scholars have not yet addressed fully or in connection with the most recent research in various archives.
You wrote this book for Jewish Publication Society, a really important Jewish publisher for a long time. It gives it, I think, maybe an even greater heft than it might have otherwise. You know, Roosevelt doesn't look good in this book.
I would put it this way. President Roosevelt does not look good according to the historical record. This is a book based on many years of deep research in the relevant archives that includes President Roosevelt's own papers and records in Hyde Park, New York, as well as the private correspondence memoranda and other documents of the major American Jewish leaders, Rabbi Wise foremost among them. And ultimately, what you will read in the book, The Jews Should Keep Quiet, is the product of what I found in these archives.
It's a very interesting time in American Jewish history. There's been a huge migration of Jews from the 1880s till the 1920s, till the gates were kind of shut, of Ashkenazic Jews, which had followed the German Jews who had been so influential in Jewish history up till that point. Were the leaders of American Jewry in that period mostly Ashkenazic Jews? Were they German Jews? What was the origin of most of them?
The main division, the main ethnic division, let's call it, within the American Jewish leadership was between German-born or German-descended Jews and those who came from Russia and other areas of Eastern Europe. Now, the German Jews, as I'll refer to them, were the original leaders of the American Jewish community because they had come over largely in the mid-1800s, and so they were the stewards of American Jewry during that earlier period. In the late 1800s and especially the early 1900s, when the masses of East European Jews fleeing from pogroms in Russia and elsewhere arrived, then the Jewish leadership in America began to change, and East European Jews began to rise to positions of leadership in various Jewish organizations. So by the time of the Roosevelt era, 1930s and then into the 1940s, you had an American Jewish community which had a division, a noticeable division between an old guard, the German-born, and East European Jews who, broadly speaking, tended to be much more assertive with their Jewish identity and much more willing to speak out when they saw Jewish rights endangered, whether in the United States or overseas.
We will talk much more with Rafael Medoff about his fascinating book, The Jews Should Keep Quiet, Franklin Roosevelt's Rabbi Stephen S. Wise and the Holocaust, give you a little personal connection to Stephen S. Wise during his career. All of that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy classes, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T, S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary safely in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. If you have religious school age children or grandchildren, join us for Splash Into School coming up Sunday, August 14th. Our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Torah Tikes, Confirmation, and Teen programs will be on full display in a fun, relaxed setting. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night or Saturday morning, you can come by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or just showing up. Or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Shabbat morning Saturday services are at 10 a.m., all on Facebook Live. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Religious school is available in blended formats too, some students live and some on Zoom. Or go to our Facebook page, BeitSimchaTucson. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our religious school and Torah Tikes, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, high school programs, fabulous array of Adult Education Academy classes, live and on Zoom, and our services in person or on Facebook, go to the website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com, or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is very popular podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 175,000 downloads on Podbean and now on Spotify, too. Please post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are helpful. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about Algeria, and I have to admit I had almost complete lack of knowledge of Algeria. I knew there were certain important Jewish scholars that came from there, and it had an important Jewish community. But I, other than that, and that the French had a brutal war there, I didn't really know much about it. You gave us a really good background on its ancient roots in Roman and then all the way up through Ottoman times. Tell us a little bit about the Jewish community in greater depth than just the simple numbers or where they live.
Right. So the Jewish community kind of waxed and waned over the centuries, depending in part on what was happening in the Jewish world and in part on who was ruling Algeria, for which the boundaries weren't set until it became a French colony in the 19th century. There were two waves of expulsions from Spain that significantly affected the Jewish population of Algeria. The first was 1391, which was mostly in Catalonia, the Balearic Islands, and places other than Andalusia, where the final expulsion that's so well known from Ferdinand and Isabella occurred in 1492.
Of course.
So both, I mean, the first one wasn't an expulsion. It was a series of pogroms and persecutions that caused a lot of Jews to leave Spain voluntarily. The second one was expulsion, and they went wherever they could. And because of strong ties between Spain and these Algerian ports, a lot of Jews actually went to Oran, which was captured in a very bloody campaign by the Spaniards. And the locals, whether Muslims, Jews, or even, it turns out, Spanish soldiers, were left kind of imprisoned in this fortress-like city, and they were paid irregularly, and they suffered disease and pestilence and poverty of all sorts. So The history of the Jews of Algeria has not always been pretty.
It got
much better in the 19th century when the French took over beginning in 1830. And initially, they treated all Algerians as French residents, but not French citizens. Then they gave Algerians in general more political rights, including seats in the French National Assembly. So Algeria became more closely integrated with France. But still, it wasn't until like 1870 or something that there was a decree by the French Prime Minister Clemieux, which said that Jews in Algeria could have full citizenship, and certain categories of Muslims could too. But that was like never very clearly defined. So Jews enjoyed a leg up in the second half of the 19th century, in the first half of the 20th century, and the population exploded. I mean, the Jewish population of Algeria rose from 20 or 30,000 at the beginning of the 19th century to 140,000 on the eve of World War II. And of course, Algeria was part of the Vichy regime, so all the anti-Jewish laws applied, but it didn't last very long there as opposed to the rest of France. And we'll finish this part of the story next week.
Thank you, Tom. Look forward to it. We'll speak then.
I look forward to it also.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. On their honeymoon night, Aaron looks down at Sadie and whispers, "Darling, am I the first man you've made love to?" And Sadie answers, "Nah, I'm sure I would have recognized you." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the second portion of the book of Deuteronomy in the Torah, the remarkable Sedra of Vaet Hanan. Vaet Hanan includes truly spectacular texts. The Shema, the central statement of God's oneness in the world. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad, hear Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Followed immediately in Deuteronomy by the Ve'ahavta, the commandment to love God with all our hearts, minds, and strength. And as if that were not enough honor for one Torah portion, Vayet Hanan also includes the recitation of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, for a second time here in the Torah. If you were to rank portions, you could easily put Vayet Hanan near the very top in quality of content. It is no accident that this powerfully affirming portion is read the week after Tisha B'Av, commemoration of the destruction of both the first and second temples on Shabbat Nachamu, the Sabbath of Consolation. For we take comfort in our knowledge that morality and holiness will ultimately bring justice. The Shema itself is really a simple sentence. Listen, Israel, God is your Lord. God is only one. It's a straightforward statement, and one that should be easy to both understand and accept. Wholeness, oneness. So simple, in fact, anyone can understand and embrace it. Although, of course, simple and true ideas often struggle for acceptance in this world. But it is the text that follows the Shema, the Ve'ahavta, that is the more subtle and in many ways more intriguing passage. For in that prayer we are commanded to love God. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, and heart. Many things in life can be commanded. Love is distinctly not one of them. So what does the Torah mean when it says we are commanded to love God? Love is essentially an unconditional way of giving, of focusing attention and caring on another being. Loving God means paying attention to God's existence in our world, to God's oneness, to God's moral code for us. In Judaism, we express love for God, our ahava, by demonstrating that we have learned how to listen, shma. For if we truly listen, then we will know that we must act ethically. Loving God means being obligated to listen to and follow God's mitzvot, to live ethical lives, to do so with energy and commitment. It also means that being good, morally good, is a form of love. perhaps the purest form. This week, may we all find a way to express that love through the righteous actions of mitzvot, and so affirm God in our world. When we return on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Raphael Medoff, shares the dramatic and fascinating story of Jewish loyalty, presidential betrayal, and the careful co-opting of a crucial Jewish leader. It's all in his new book, The Jews Should Keep Quiet, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, and the Holocaust. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Canada's 380,000 Jews were the most targeted religious minority for hate crimes reported to police in Canada in 2021, the country's official numbers keeper reported. Statistics Canada said the Jewish community, comprising just 1% of the population, were victims of 14% of reported hate crimes. Canadian Jews saw a 47% rise in reported hate crimes compared to 2020. Oof. We are deeply concerned that incidents of hate crimes rose yet again in Canada in 2021, said Shimon Kofler-Fogel, head of the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. This disturbing trend clearly proves the need for more proactive measures to stop the rising hate, targeting diverse Canadians based on their identity. Only black Canadians, who make up 3.5% of the country's population, reported more hate crimes. Overall, 1.3 Canadian Jews in every 1,000 reported being victims of hate crimes in 2021. Statistically, Canadian Jews are more than 10 times more likely than any other Canadian religious minority to report being the target of a hate crime, Fogel said. That's alarming, indeed. Canada's official tally showed the same trend as the reports of anti-Semitic incidents in other countries last year. The Netherlands, France, and the UK all reported increased incidents of anti-Semitism, while the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, a nonprofit here in the U.S., of course, said it recorded more anti-Semitic incidents last year than at any time since it began tracking them in 1979. Wow. In Europe, Hungary's top rabbis have added their voice to a torrent of criticism about a speech by right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orban in which he said Hungarians do not want to become peoples of mixed races. Orban, whose far-right rhetoric has long galvanized his base and millions abroad while angering others, made the remark during her speech in Romania, decrying the arrival to Europe of millions of Muslims. Orban's remarks prompted an advisor, Zusa Hegedus, to resign. In a letter announcing her resignation, Hegedus, who is Jewish, called the speech a pure Nazi diatribe worthy of Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda chief, Yimach Shmo. Rabbi Robert Freilich, the chief rabbi of the Majij umbrella group of Hungarian Jewish communities, said that Orban's remark was a violation of human dignity and morals. Shlomo Kovas, the head of the EMIH Orthodox umbrella of Jewish communities in Hungary, called Orban's choice of words unfortunate, saying it was not compatible with Judeo-Christian values. The rabbi's criticism is notable because in Hungary, they typically refrain from criticizing the prime minister, even when others do. Deborah Lipstadt, the U.S. State Department's anti-Semitism monitor, past guest of Too Jewish, also condemned Orban's speech, deeply alarmed by the Hungarian prime minister's use of rhetoric that clearly evokes Nazi racial ideology, she said, adding that the rhetoric was especially inexcusable for one who claims zero tolerance of anti-Semitism. In part of the speech pertaining to peoples of the Carpathian region, Orban said, "We're willing to mix with each other, but we don't want to become a mixed race." He characterized Muslims moving to Hungary as a flood being forced upon the country in rhetoric that echoes replacement theory, the racist sentiment animating many white supremacists. Orban spoke this past week at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference he was invited to in the U.S. In May, he hosted a CPAC convening in Hungary. There, a Hungarian writer known for anti-Semitic remarks was a featured speaker. Focusing on the issue of race in speeches is unusual for Orban himself, but he has made multiple statements that were racist and anti-Semitic. In 2018, he used terms in a speech that echoed Nazi propaganda against Jews. Then he said, "We are fighting an enemy that is different from us, not open but hiding, not straightforward but crafty, not honest but base, not national but international, does not believe in working but speculates with money, does not have its own homeland but feels it owns the whole world." Orban made a rare concession to his critics when he offered a clarification about his recent comments. "It happens I speak in ambiguous terms," he said in a press conference. "We are proud of what Hungary has achieved in the fight against racism. The speech in Romania is not about racism. It's about cultural differences." In a letter to Hegedus, his former advisor, Orban wrote, "You can't be serious accusing me of racism after 20 years of working together. You know that, according to my understanding, God created all people in his own image. Therefore, in the case of people like me, racism is excluded from the get-go. You know, except for Muslims and, you know, maybe Jews." In his statement about Orban's speech, Kovesh, the Orthodox rabbi, said any discussion of race at all is unfortunate. A significant part of the speech was about the loss of space in Western Judeo-Christian culture and the challenges this poses. Kovesh said, "One of the fundamental values of Judeo-Christian civilization is that God created every human being in his own image. For this reason alone, it is particularly unfortunate to speak of races and mixed races." Mischling. And a remarkable American Jew died last week. Southern Jewish author and Jewish philanthropy world giant Eli Evans passed away from complications of COVID just shy of his 86th birthday. His memoirs and essays in books like The Provincials and The Lonely Days Were Sundays presented a picture of Jewish life in the American South in a way that was both endearing and insightful. I know that Evans' work helped me adapt to life as a rabbi in South Carolina when I began my own career there. Eli Evans went on to head the Revson Foundation, supported a variety of important philanthropic projects, including Rehov Sumsum, the much-beloved Sesame Street spinoff in Hebrew that taught many a Jewish kid about cooperation, Hebrew words, and Jewish ideals. Eli Evans was also instrumental in the Carnegie Corporation, a philanthropic group supporting Abba Eban's Civilization and the Jews, a very influential TV series. May his memory continue to bring blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rafael Medoff is the author of The Jews Should Keep Quiet, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Rabbi Stephen S. Wise and the Holocaust. Fascinating book from Jewish Publication Society. You focus on Rabbi Wise. I just want to mention my grandmother in Portland, Oregon, had him as her confirmation teacher when he was the assistant rabbi at Congregation Beth Israel there in the early 1900s. Wise is a compelling figure, very important figure, is very significant synagogues named after him today, but he's a complicated figure in this regard. Can you give us a little of his background and his story?
Rabbi Wise was very much a unique type of Jewish leader. You don't see someone like Wise today. He was the head of at least half a dozen major Jewish organizations and institutions simultaneously. After leaving the pulpit that you mentioned in Oregon, he came to New York City, where he was the head of another important synagogue. But at the same time, he was the head of a rabbinical seminary, which he founded, then known as the Jewish Institute of Religion. It later merged with Hebrew Union College, the Reform Movement's flagship rabbinical institution.
In the interest of full disclosure, one of my alma mater, HUCJIR, it's called Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, the combined institution.
He was the head, one of the founders and leaders of the American Jewish Congress throughout those decades. He was the founder and co-leader of the World Jewish Congress. He was a leader of the American Zionist movement for much of those years, the 30s and 40s. So, and he also served, by the way, on the boards of directors of numerous important Jewish organizations and some that were not Jewish, such as the American Civil Liberties Union. He was an incredibly energetic and active individual, and he was arguably the most prominent, most influential figure in the American Jewish leadership in the 1930s and 1940s. Part of his stature derived from the fact that he was leader of these important Jewish institutions, but part of it, an important part, was that he had a unique relationship with the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt.
You write early in the book that Wise's initial impressions of Roosevelt were not positive. He actually voted for Norman Thomas rather than vote for Roosevelt in 32. He said he has no bedrock, he is all clay and no granite. That changed once Roosevelt became president and started to enact the New Deal.
So Roosevelt became a president at the beginning of 1933. He was inaugurated in early 1933. By 1935, early 1936, Rabbi Wise was back in his good graces. That's when their relationship really began. Now, it was not the kind of relationship between a president and a Jewish leader that we would expect today, which is to say, nowadays, a Jewish leader might have a meeting with the president, or a group of Jewish leaders might have a meeting with the president, and then it would be expected that afterwards there would be a photo op and there would be some kind of a public statement about the meeting. The fascinating thing, one of the fascinating things about Rabbi Wise's relationship with Roosevelt was how much of it was conducted out of the limelight by Roosevelt's request. When you look at the cover of the book, The Jews Should Keep Quiet, you see images of FDR and Rabbi Wise. But if you look closely, you see that they're not side by side. When we were designing the cover, we went looking for a photo of the two men, naturally, since the entire running theme of the book has to do with their relationship. And we came to the conclusion that no such photo existed, even though Rabbi Wise had met President Roosevelt a number of times in the White House over the years. Roosevelt did not want to be photographed with him. Roosevelt did not want it to be known that he had a connection with Rabbi Wise. And so part of the tragedy of their relationship was, despite Wise's fierce loyalty and the ways in which Wise defended Roosevelt and Roosevelt's record to the Jewish community, Wise could not even get what we would call a photo op with the president.
It's fascinating. You know, Wise was an activist, right, and often a very vocal one. His sermons, his public pronouncements were activist and energized. He criticized the German Jewish establishment for its caution frequently and openly. But when it came to Roosevelt, can we say he had the wool pulled over his eyes?
In the book, I portray what I would call an evolution in Rabbi Wise's public activism. He certainly began his career as an outspoken fighter for various causes, not just Jewish causes. And he was known as someone who had the courage to say unpopular things and to embrace controversial causes. But during the years of his relationship with FDR, the mid to late 30s and then into the 1940s, the Holocaust period, one can see how he gradually retreated. So while you are correct in noting that early on he was critical of the German-born American Jewish leaders for being too cautious and too quiet, by the time one gets into the early 1940s, the similarities between Wise and those he criticized had really decreased significantly, and it's almost impossible to distinguish between them. Wise, in his strong affection for President Roosevelt, the Democratic Party, and the New Deal, became I would say spokesman, but he was almost a spokesman for Roosevelt. I'm going to say almost a spokesman for Roosevelt in the Jewish community. He, in effect, sold American Jews on the idea that the president was doing all he possibly could to help rescue the Jews from the Nazis. And if Jews weren't being rescued, Wise told them, it was because there just wasn't much that could be done. When we look back today and we are surprised to note that FDR received 90% or more of Jewish votes each time he ran, approximately, a number which is almost unheard of in modern American politics, we need to keep in mind that what ordinary American Jews were being told by their leaders, starting with Rabbi Wise, was that Roosevelt was their friend and he was doing the best he could. The sad truth, as I document in the book, is that Wise knew that Roosevelt was not making any serious effort to help the Jews in Europe, and that there were opportunities to rescue more Jews from the Holocaust that Roosevelt was not taking advantage of because of his own perceived political interests.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, the book covers a solid piece of time in which there's other crucial Jewish issues. But of course, as we come closer and closer to the Holocaust, we know what's going to happen, the abiding sense of doom. What could Roosevelt have done, and why didn't he do it?
Let's start with the question of immigration. The most obvious way that the United States could have helped Jewish refugees in the 1930s, this is the pre-Holocaust period, was to allow more German Jews and other Jews to come into the United States. In those days, American immigration was governed by a quota system, which set a limit on how many people could come from any given country in 1 year. So, for example, from Germany in the 1930s, the quota was approximately 27,000 per year. But the remarkable thing that one discovers in looking at the old immigration statistics is that the 27,000 quota was almost never filled. In fact, it was filled in only 1 year during the entire period we're talking about, from 1933 to 1945. And in most of those years, it was only 25% filled. That means you had a significant number of quota places that were simply discarded. At the end of the year, an empty quota spot did not roll over into the next year. It was thrown out. So year after year, there were thousands and thousands of quota places from Germany that could have been used to rescue Jews who were fleeing from Hitler, but were never used. If you add up all of the unused quota places from Germany and then later from Axis-occupied countries, 1933 to 1945, it comes to over 190,000. So that's nearly 200,000 Jews who could have been saved within the existing immigration system. I stress that because sometimes in contemporary debates, we hear defenders of President Roosevelt's record saying, well, we had a quota system. He couldn't change the quota system unilaterally. He couldn't go fight with Congress and ask for liberalization of the system. He never would have got it. And it's true that Congress would not have agreed to liberalize the immigration system. But what I'm pointing out here is the crucial fact that the system did not need to be liberalized to save 200,000 refugees. They could have been simply admitted under the existing quotas. And that's the first tragedy of this whole story of Roosevelt's abandonment of the Jews, is how much could have been done for so little. It wouldn't have required any argument with Congress, any public controversy. It wouldn't have mattered whether some portion of the public was unhappy about it. It was the law. That was the immigration system. And that system, by the way, remained in place until the 1960s. So that was one of the most obvious ways in which Jews could have been rescued.
I feel like we could go on for twice this length. The book is called The Jews Should Keep Quiet, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Rabbi Stephen S. Wise and the Holocaust by Raphael Medoff. I think the most comprehensive exploration of this topic that we've seen yet, and a very important book. Just one last question. In your view, was Roosevelt an anti-Semite or a closet anti-Semite even?
It's an important question, and one which I explore in depth in the book, because over the past decade or so, historians, including me, have unearthed statements that Roosevelt made behind the scenes about Jews that were less than flattering. Actually, I'm being too charitable. Readers will see that they were statements that were unquestionably what we would today call anti-Semitic. Now, the question of whether or not his private anti-Semitic sentiments influenced his decision to close the doors to Jewish refugees or to help them in any other way, that's a key historical matter which I delve into in great depth in the book, and which I feel that I have answered in a way the previous historians were not able to.
I want to thank Raphael Medoff for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the book and about you?
The book is published by the Jewish Publication Society of America together with the University of Nebraska Press. And it can be found on Amazon or on the websites of the two co-publishers. I am the director of a Holocaust Research Institute based in Washington, D.C., the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies. Our website is WymanInstitute.org, WymanInstitute.org.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Jeffrey Breslow, creator of famous board and electronic games like Masterpiece, Barrel of Monkeys, Rock'em Sock'em Robots, and Simon. His story as the youngest head of a nearly all-Jewish-led popular toy company and leading it after a terrible tragedy, how it rebounded from that to back to creativity, well, it's fascinating. Don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. for Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page, and splash into school next Sunday with our religious school kickoff party. Our playout this morning comes from Israel, Eden Ben-Zakein and A.L. Golan's new song, Elef Kochavim, A Thousand Stars. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.